action.
Bro, great. All right,
Adam. There we go.
Eben, how are you?
I'm good. Happy Father's Day.
Happy Father's Day, indeed.
Yes, it is. It is Father's Day, indeed. And
yes.
Yes.
Episode 43
of the Mythmakers podcast.
Good God.
So welcome to the Mythmakers podcast. This show is all about storytelling, the process, people, and power of story.
Yes.
It's often about us as M2, but we also talk to other people. And ultimately, I think it's really about the great work that people are doing in all mediums. And kind of the things that we're doing, that other people are doing, and the things that excite us and kind of thrill us in the general world of storytelling.
Just the fun to be had.
The fun to be had. So if you haven't been listening, Adam and I together have about 40 years of experience creating, producing, directing, and making content.
Stuff.
Yep. All around in different mediums. And we're up to a bunch of cool stuff right now as well. So
indeed,
we'll talk a little bit more about that. But you know what? For a little change of pace, why don't we kind of jump right into tonight's topic?
Indeed.
And I'll let you kind of take it away because this is your idea.
Yes, indeed. So what we were, you know, kind of looking at, just looking around the week and what we've been up to and how things were going, and looking at very specifically this weekend was the release of Incredibles 2, which I have seen this morning.
I have not. I will say this. So Adam's kids are, what are your children's ages?
15 and 10,
yes. Right? And I have 5 and 2. Mm-hmm. So I very much look forward to the days when I am taking them to all of these things that I want
yes.
to see, because right now I am not. So I always feel behind the eight ball a little bit with my geek credentials, as
right.
I have not seen these things as early as I should.
Indeed, it is.
It
very
pains
nice.
Me. It pains me.
It's the joy and the curse of having children that are kind of, I think, entertainment industry savvy.
Yes, yes.
In that they know the release schedules of when things are coming and what they're doing, and
yes.
so they are planning out the weekends kind of months in advance. Both things coming here. So can we go and see this on this day? And can we do this on this day? And
yes.
Oh my goodness.
And you know what's funny? I don't think I mentioned to you. So you know, Austin and I were doing, at least my 5-year-old is doing, weekly movie days,
mm-hmm.
and we had started down this path of you know, some classic
Disney
and animation, Miyazaki, and she got really into it. And then the last kind of couple of months, like every time I go, like, hey, let's go watch a movie or have a movie day, and she's like, nah, I want to play.
Nope.
I'm like, all right.
Hey.
But man, there's a part of me that's just like, come on. So I'm sure it'll come back. But
yes,
she is definitely a child of YouTube more than cinema at the moment, which is a shame.
Fascinating.
A real shame.
Yes.
But also a good, you know, kind of a good case study
just
for a lot of
exactly.
the things that we're working on.
Well, no, and it's been an interesting education with all that stuff with Kira. So my 15-year-old is very much her go-to kind of casual entertainment is YouTube
yep.
still. Although she'll go and binge a series. She does have a TV show
yes.
she's addicted to. And movies have always been something we've done together as a family. And obviously when she was little, you and I used to take her a good deal. And,
yep.
you know, so it's interesting.
It'll
for
come
Austin,
around.
Especially yep. growing up with YouTube as such a key player.
It is, yes. Now here's what I do get a kick out of, which is they don't know the stories at all, but I do play a good amount of kind of geeky movie music with them.
Mm-hmm.
So like we will march around the house to the Imperial March and stuff like that.
Fantastic.
And it's great. And I have this sort of like delayed gratification knowing that at some point these dots are going
right.
to get connected.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I just imagine this world where they're like, oh my God, this, but that, but. And I'll get to revel in that in the future.
Oh, so. Yes. Oh yes.
So off of the back of The Incredibles 2.
Yeah. We were talking about just thing I'm wondering about, you know, discussing kind of animation production in general and
yes.
how, you know, they had a very interesting thing at the head of this Incredibles where they did look at, they were essentially, it's kind of funny, but they were essentially apologizing for it having been 14 years since the last Incredibles.
Right.
Which is bizarre to think it was that long.
Mm, yes.
I could have had it in my head as well. It was about 9 years ago.
Right. Would be long in and of itself.
Long,
but
right.
For a teen, yes.
And the fact that it's been this long, and obviously it appears, I sell some early numbers saying it's kind of $150 million opening.
Biggest opening ever for an animated feature.
Yep.
Yes.
Which is fantastic. And by and large, very well deserved.
As a side note, I also just saw today that Infinity War's domestic box office has now surpassed Justice League's worldwide box office.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Lots of shakeups at DC
Black Panther didn't surpass worldwide.
Yes. Yeah.
But it did, obviously, it's worldwide eclipsed.
Yes. Absolutely.
Eclipsed Justice League.
Yep.
Yes.
Yeah,
as Marvel will Ant-Man and Wasp, I would guess,
probably
right up around it.
Although I read it's tracking at sort of 550 or something, which is still very respectable number.
What did Justice League cap at? Seven
something. Yeah, yeah.
God.
Yeah, lots of shakeups.
They lost money.
Now, have you seen also? So we're tangenting into pop culture stuff for a moment here, but you may have also seen there have been a big shakeup at DC Comics, especially DC Films, but also really the whole division this past week with Geoff Johns moving into a producer role at Warner Brothers. Jim Lee taking over as the editor and publisher of DC Comics, or co-publisher and kind of editor, chief creative, replacing Geoff Johns. And then Diane, I'm totally going to mess up her name, but I think it's Diane Nelson, who we actually met with a couple of times.
Oh, yes.
Who is most famous for bringing Harry Potter to Warner Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
But she was in charge of the DC division for a long time. So we met with them, with her specifically,
years ago,
when we were first starting into this whole kind of motion comics animation world.
Mm-hmm.
We met Guy DC, who then brought us in to meet with her. She has just stepped down as well. So there's kind of lots of reshuffling kind of what's going on over there. Now, the good news is I do hear for those people that do like DC characters, apparently Aquaman is getting incredibly positive.
Oh, really?
Early buzz anyway.
Now, that was James Wan.
That is James Wan. Yeah. And so apparently
he's a good storyteller.
And apparently, they've taken some lessons apparently from these past not as
you would have
wonderful.
Thought they'd learned those lessons a long time ago.
You would have thought. Oh, so hopefully this is the start of a good new direction for those of us in this fan world, which is kind of everybody now.
Yeah, no, exactly.
So anyway, classic animation production. So, we've talked in the past, and you can find other shows in this podcast series talking about sort of our production methodology and the way that we've tended to approach animation and kind of the way that we've kind of developed our own take on
the process
and kind of figured out a way to at this point kind of combine motion graphics with traditional animation to find a sort of
cool
best of both worlds hybrid that can be done at a reasonable production budget and all that stuff. But we thought it would be interesting to kind of talk about the actual kind of more traditional animation process. And I think we can...
Particularly as it pertains, obviously, to Pixar and what they're doing. But
Pixar,
it's the same process.
But it's the same. And actually, I'll shout out to this. I'll look it up while we're talking here. But I've just started listening to a new podcast, which I'll recommend for anyone that's interested in traditional animation. It's called Drawn, the Story of Animation.
Ooh.
And I've just heard the first couple of episodes, but it's really interesting. And it actually is talking about the history of animation and relevant to this conversation. So one of the things that they talk about in the last episode I listened to is, the cyclical kind of interesting nature of animation in general. And as much as I, Walt Disney is a personal hero of mine, one of the things they point out is that pre-Disney, animation was very much a everybody medium. It was something that, was not geared towards kids in particular.
Right.
And that, there was an animated short in front of just about every movie. Every studio had their own animation division.
Really? See, I had no idea.
And it was, you know, really Disney came in and kind of realized like, hey, we could, you know, kind of target this towards, you know, the family audience, the kids audience, and that changed the world of animation, ultimately resulting in most studios shutting down their animation divisions because he kind of, you know, took it over.
Yes.
But very interesting. And so we have found now this kind of cyclical, over the last, you know, couple of decades, really starting with The Simpsons, sort of resurgence of, you know, more adult animation. Mm-hmm. And then, they also talk about, which is also really interesting, the birth of Cartoon Network and Adult Swim in particular. Right. And what I had not realized is the history of Cartoon Network is actually Ted Turner coming to one of his executives and saying like, hey, we can buy the Hanna-Barbera library. Or now I'm blanking on a couple of others. So there are basically three candidates for like, if we were to buy one of these libraries, what could we do with it?
Right.
And there's this one executive that was like, hey, if we got the Hanna-Barbera library, there's enough content there to make a network. And that was the birth of Cartoon Network.
Interesting.
And so Adult Swim started with, you know, and really the beginning of this kind of golden age of animation started with that beginning of Cartoon Network, and then them doing their first original series, which was Space Ghost Coast to Coast, which they could do at an incredibly cheap budget by repurposing Hanna-Barbera cartoons and wrapping them in these sort of bumpers in this sort of talk show format. And then that became so successful that they were rivaling the ratings of a couple of other cable networks. And so they're like, oh, this is working. And that led to the resurgence of kind of auteur driven animated content on TV.
Interesting.
And then that all, of course, kind of played into the rise of Pixar and everything else.
Right.
So there's this kind of opportunity to create, you know, content and animated content in particular that was kind of geared at these different segments of the audience.
Interesting.
Very, very great show. And you know, anyone that is interested in animation or just likes animation,
that's
it's really
out.
Interesting,
yes.
You know, kind of history of all of that. Right. So from a process standpoint or from a production standpoint, you know, it's been a while since I've been involved in the like truly the traditional animation process,
yeah.
But I have done some of it. And famously in my life, when I was running my, production and media company prior to M2, we actually got approached by a Korean animation studio that came to us and said, hey, like we have this production resource, like we have this team of animators and, you know, we're very good at what we do, but we don't really have a Western sensibility. Can you guys create something?
Right.
We'll be the animation kind of back end.
Right.
And so that was, you know, I met an animator in Ojai where I was at the time who had been working at kind of every major studio and really had all that experience. And so he actually kind of mentored me in the traditional animation process at that point. And I'm sure
that was Harangi and Gachi.
I was Harangi and Gachi. So we ended up producing a pilot and kind of animated short pilot for this series. It was a young tiger and his companion Magpie.
Based on
Korean folktales and mythology, but geared towards a Western audience.
Right.
And sort of like, you know, kind of madcap adventure between these two characters. And we had the whole, you know, series planned out and ready to pitch, and we put all that stuff together. And just, you know, famously, like we did finish production on the short, and then immediately thereafter, the company that was to be the animation company got bought by another company and shut down their animation division. So, but what that process was for me was a sort of crash course. I did some animation in college, but that was a real crash course in like, you know, the real process. And I'm sure things have become more digital.
Yes.
But, you know, like the idea of doing like timing sheets and turnarounds and like all that stuff.
I think a lot of that stuff, from what I see,
it still exists.
It's very much part of how you hone it.
Yes.
So, you know, I think correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the basic process is, you know, obviously you have your script, with the script.
Yep.
And then it's the kind of process of rough, often hand-drawn storyboards for each scene. So it's very broad strokes. Here's kind of how the scenes are playing.
Mm-hmm.
Then from there, there's scratch vocals recorded.
Yep.
So scratch vocals being, you know, it's a friend of mine used to work at Disney. I mean, he happens to be actually quite a talented actor and voice actor, but Alex.
Yeah.
And he would, you know, they would use kind of members of the team who had some acting talent who would then voice these things.
Yes.
And they would pull in some other kind of players basically to come in and just get a sense of the timing of the of the show and then refine the storyboards to that edit.
Yes.
So then you're kind of, you know, you're kind of hanging on frames long enough and you're working out where the cuts start to come. And then once that is working in general, then you start going and doing, and obviously while that's happening, you're building your digital models, you're doing all the kind of back end work on the character creation side. But having got that timing edit then in place, you then turn around and start.
So I think the one, yes, absolutely. I think the one distinction there, and it depends on, you know, what, I mean, different studios and different productions handle it in different ways. I think, you know, something like The Simpsons or Family Guy actually does tend to start with a script, like a more traditional television script.
Right.
A lot of other animated productions actually, and actually I think this is true in Pixar and a lot of Disney feature production. It's actually less a finished script and more of an outline. And then the storyboard artists actually play a big role in kind of finishing, kind of figuring out the real beats of the story. So they'll often be dozens of iterations of the way that particular scenes play or the way that, you know, different jokes are implemented or different things. And so they'll, you know, especially in these larger productions, they'll be, you know, putting all the boards up on the wall and then kind of pitching the scenes or sequences, you know, to the rest of the team, and then, you know, seeing what people react to, what's funny, where do the laughs come from, you know, and then going back and taking that feedback and revising. And then the script actually comes as, you know, kind of all part of that process of kind of visually telling the story. And I think there's something kind of magical about that, and that, you know, you're kind of taking like, oh, this is a visual medium that we have to create, you know, from scratch. So let's actually figure this out in the visuals as much as in the actual words.
Which is more in a funny way. It's more the kind of Marvel method of comics creation.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where it's kind of like, here's the story area. Now artists go figure it out.
Yeah.
And we'll kind of add the words.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And so for that short that we did, you know, for Hurrying Gengachi, we actually did a hybrid version of that where we had sort of an outline and then very much figured out in storyboard stage. And then those timing edits became critically important where we were kind of cutting those boards together in various ways and iterations and adding stuff, tweaking stuff. So I think part of it is like, you know, the cheapest part of the production is that kind of sketch stage.
Right.
And so the more you can get nailed, you know, early in that format, the more, you know, the cheaper it's going to be to actually produce the animation.
Yes.
You know, and then the other components of that, and this was one of the fun things for me and one of the things that I did on that show and I've actually done a couple of other times as well is, you know, one of my loves is character design. And then for animation in particular, there's a tweak on that, which is it's not, especially for 2D animation. So you're assuming in many cases, like I'm going to design these characters, but I need to send them off to somebody else who's actually going to draw these things in movement, in, you know, kind of frame by frame animation.
Yes, of course.
And so not only are you giving them, this is a front, a side, a back, like here's a turnaround of this character. But there's also character sheets, which are instructive to this animation team, especially when you're going overseas, to say, yes, here are the things you should do and here are the things you should not do. And so I remember like with those Hurrengi and Gachi characters, you know, with Hurrengi in particular, part of the design of that character was like his feet had a kind of a particular wedge shape to them. So they were, you know, kind of thinner at the back towards the ankle, you know, fatter towards the toes.
Right.
So one of those things on those characters model sheets were, you know, here's a couple of examples of what you should do and here's a couple of examples of what you shouldn't do. And so as much as possible, you're trying to kind of, you know, give enough guidance to the team that's going to be creating these animated frames that the drawings are going to come back the way that you want them to.
Obviously, less of an issue with a Pixar where everything's done in house, where everyone is standing and looking at these same boards.
Well, it's looking at that, and also I think when you're doing something in 3D, you know, the benefit of that is you're creating an actual model. You know,
of course.
Once that's approved, like this is the character model. It is the way way that it is, and everybody's working from
it. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Now, it used to be that obviously people would handle specific characters.
Yes.
Right? So in traditional animation, there's a lot of, it's like, great, if you're,
well, especially in classic Disney, yeah.
You would be responsible for Pinocchio or
yes.
the fox
yes.
or the kids
mm-hmm.
or this kid or whatever it is.
Yes.
And so you'd have multiple people working on any one element of a
yes.
scene
yes.
at the same time. And I think a specific reason for that is so that the style of the character remains identical throughout.
The style of the character, and also I sure. have the style of the character, yes, but also in Disney in particular, they would almost treat it like each animator was the actor for that character. And so a lot of the reason for giving a particular animator a particular character was to maintain a performance. So, you know, they would very much think like, okay, you know, as you got to be a more senior animator and you know, famously the Wise Old Men in classic Disney animation, they were kind of eight, you know, kind of the most senior, most experienced, you know, kind of phenomenal animators in classic Disney films. You know, each of those would kind of take one of the lead characters, and they would literally be the ones responsible for the performance of that character. And so you might not assign based on someone's particular style, drawing style, because you've kind of all assimilated into like, this is the style of this show. But rather, it's like, oh, this guy is really good at gag, so give him the funny character. You know, this guy is really good at, you know, realistic, you know, performance, so give him the princess, you know, or whatever those decision-making process is. And actually, I think that was one of the big distinctions or one of the big shifts in Pixar, especially, was they went from assigning animators for particular characters to assigning animators to entire sequences or entire scenes. And so actually one of my good friends from RISD is now a co-director and longtime animator at Pixar.
Nice.
I have a few actual classmates at Pixar.
Nice, excellent.
But I know it was exciting to me in Toy Story 3, like seeing his name in the credits. And like there's one sequence in particular where, I think it's Toy Story 2 actually, where Woody, you know, pops out of the collectible case that he's in, and
right.
he has this kind of like, hey, like cowboy, I'm not gonna be able to do it in audio, but it's kind of like swagger. That is like that motion. Like I don't know for sure, but I would bet money that was animated by my friend from RISD, because it's like,
that's
I've
so
seen him do that. Like, so like when I saw that movie, I was like, that's it.
Yeah. Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
So yeah. So I think, you know, I think that the, you know, and then again, kind of back to the podcasting, it's like we live in this time now where there really is this sort of auteur driven,
mm-hmm.
you know, component to animation, which was also not the case in the golden days in an interesting way. So, you know, now, you know, it's like you'll have, you know, one of the distinctions they talk about, and it's very true, if you track back through the history of animation, like, you know, Disney would kind of go like, this is the style of this film, but it was still sort of a house style, or even more so in the kind of Hanna-Barbera age, or, you know, Tom and Jerry, or, you know, any of those sort of, you know, older shows. Whereas, you know, you look at a lot of stuff, especially on television now, it's like you've got someone who has come in and pitched the show, and often it's like this is the drawing style of that person that's now being translated into this show. So, you know, like Seth MacFarlane, another example with Family Guy, or, you know, with Matt Groening from The Simpsons, like that is their drawing style, you know, put on screen and as
in
these characters.
Right.
You know, the South Park guys be another example of that. So it's like, you know, finding the everything from the style of storytelling to the actual aesthetic of the animation itself, you know, being very much driven by the voice behind the show, or being the person behind the show.
And then, you know, and then of course you look at The Simpsons or Family Guy as obviously the big examples on television of that very, you know, more traditional animation style, and the time it takes to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So The Simpsons,
mm-hmm.
yeah, they're in production on episodes that don't air for 9 months.
Absolutely.
Massive turnaround versus a South Park, where they basically got this kind of asset library and it's plug and play, and they're writing scripts that week that they're then taking 2 days to animate.
Yeah, which is amazing.
Which is incredible.
I mean, if you've ever seen, if anyone has not seen, I think there's a documentary, a little short documentary about making South Park. I think it's called like 6 days to
Yes.
6 days to air or something like that. But like literally the 6 day process from script to delivering the tape the day that it needs to go on TV.
I've spoken to a few people. I've spoken to a few people who have been involved with South Park. And they do say it's, you know, you get this period of kind of waiting and sleeping at your desk.
Right.
As you're waiting for the script to arrive with the vocals. And then it's suddenly like, oh my God.
Here we go. Yeah. You know?
So it's not very conducive to family atmosphere.
Yes. But it is very conducive to topical stuff. Yeah.
There was a writer I met, I met a while ago who said that, you know, he'd gone from The Simpsons to South Park.
Yes.
The Simpsons, you know, very classic writer's room and everything's planned out and everything. And then, you know, going scum day one, you know, Monday, South Park had aired the previous night and they're up and running. It's like, great, what do you do this week?
Yes. What do you mean this week?
What do you mean this week?
Yeah.
Which is amazing.
Yeah. Well, what I find fascinating about South Park too, and it, you know, certainly an outlier, I don't think any other show is actually made like South Park is made. So a good example of like, you know, finding, you know, a lot of topics actually that we've talked about on this show, but kind of using the constraints of the style as a real asset.
Yes.
And I think what's fascinating to me is like those early episodes of South Park, the first couple of seasons literally were construction paper. Like they look like that because that's how they were made. And then over the course of, you know, these 15 years or whatever seasons that have, you know, now been aired, like they've digitized everything. And so you can see in that, as you were saying, it's like you can see in that documentary, it's like they've kind of created this, you know, library of digital assets. And so now it's like it can be done so quickly because all that stuff is already in place. Right. And then the style of the show is, you know, kind of completely made intentionally for that ability and sort of all works
together. I wonder if that works as well. And it must work with, you look at a show, I mean, it's, oh my God, I got my mic on it. 101 Days of Summer Vacation, Cartoon Network show, two kids. What? Perry the Platypus.
I don't know that one.
What the hell?
Perry the Platypus. Well, I'll talk about Powerpuff Girls for a moment. So, you know, I love Powerpuff Girls. Another example of kind of auteur driven, you know, very, very much based on the artist that created it. It is Perry the Platypus, if that's who you're talking about.
It was.
But you know, as an interesting anecdote, which also came from this other show that I was listening to, but Powerpuff Girls started. So one of the things that that Adult Swim and Cartoon Network did, which is not dissimilar from some of the stuff that we're talking about in our own work, is they started this anthology show where they would do these like series of shorts and kind of gauge audience reaction to those series of shorts.
And that's cool.
Powerpuff Girls was one of those ones that made it kind of through that gauntlet. And interesting at the time, you know, it was apparently like no one thought it was very funny. They just kind of liked the style of it.
Right.
And so then they, you know, ended up turning into a show and it became, you know, kind of the phenomenon that it is.
Right.
And I think kind of hit at the sweet spot of like, you know, kids animation, but action adventure, you know, kind of all in that that's kind of middle ground.
A lot of fun. And presumably then, but also it must be, they are reusing assets. They are.
To a degree, yeah. So, and I think that's another thing, actually, that's a good distinction. So, you know, Hanna-Barbera actually became successful because they were able to also create stuff, you know, unlike, you know, one of the things that like classic Looney Tunes, right, taking a step back, classic Looney Tunes was, you know, kind of in the era of, you know, apparently, you know, not atypical for adults on the train to be talking about the Looney Tunes cartoon that played in front of the movie, but that they saw last night. Right. So that's that kind of, you know, age of animation, not necessarily geared towards kids.
Right.
And then when animation went to TV, that's where it really started to become, you know, in addition to the Disney effect, started to become more this sort of child's medium because you had Saturday morning cartoons. And then Hanna-Barbera rose to prominence because they were able to essentially kind of do what South Park does in an earlier version of that, where literally instead of, I mean, if you watch a Hanna-Barbera cartoon, they're like every, it's a still of a character with a moving mouth and facial expression, and then they'll kind of do whatever they're doing in that moment, and then it'll be a switch to a different pose, but it's not frame-by-frame animation. It's sort of a hybrid medium. So it's in a lot of ways much more similar to this type of work that we've done in a different context. So it's, you know, once again, kind of figuring out how to deliver a production that is entertaining and, you know, certainly, you know, got an audience that loved that material, but at a price point that was much lower and at a turnaround time that was much quicker
for television as opposed
to television. Exactly.
Yes.
And so I think a lot of what you see in that kind of early Cartoon Network stuff, and even still now in some of the TV animation, is sort of various levels of sort of the all the way to the Hanna-Barbera style to full animation and somewhere in between on that spectrum. Right. And you'll also see in a lot of those shows, like you can actually, if you're watching, you can literally see like, oh, this is the big set piece. So this is the one that's kind of really fully animated. And then these, you know, kind of more talking sequences are kind of more limited animation and kind of some places in between.
It kind of goes back to what we were discussing last week with regard to Upgrade, mm-hmm. right? The picking and choosing where you're going to spend your time and money.
That's right.
And then chomp through the rest of your schedule so that you can take the time you need to produce these kind of key sequences.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So, and then actually I'll just, one other thing for me, which is I will burned into my brain in my, in that Harangi and Gachi short that we did. So one of the other things that I had to learn is, so you create your character models, you create your turnarounds, you create all that stuff. You have your storyboards.
Turnarounds meaning literally.
Turnarounds character literally meaning like front view, side view, back view. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So you have this, you know, all this material that you put together that, again, is sort of meant to be, not sort of, it is meant to be instruction for the animators. So you're putting that stuff together, you're putting together your storyboards, and then you also do what's called layouts. And so layouts are essentially key frames in each sequence at the size and ratio of the show. Not necessarily finished art. In fact, not finished art, but it's, you know, sort of, you'll have a background image on one layer.
Yes.
And so when we were doing this, it was all on paper. Now it would all be digital.
Of course.
But, you know, you would have a background layer and then you would have an overlay of the key poses for the characters in the scene.
Right.
And so that might be, you know, okay, this character is, you know, jumping over here and then they're swinging on a tree branch over here. So there might be a few different kind of key poses
in any one
background. So any one layout might be one background and a handful of different characters or key poses. And then you'll take that, all of those key scenes,
yes,
put those in a folder, put the characters in a folder. And then the other thing, which I think most people
literally a folder
at that time. And a lot of things, one of the things that I did not know prior to that, and I think most people don't know, is then there's what's called timing sheets. And this is what the kind of directorial part of animation when you're sending stuff overseas is you're literally, it's this kind of grid format, almost like a spreadsheet.
Right.
And you're literally taking each scene and delineating on this, you know, spreadsheet format, how many frames does each action take? And so what's interesting about that is the only thing you have to go on there is kind of like gut and a stopwatch.
Right.
So like, again, I'm sure there are better tools now,
but
at that point it was like, you're literally sitting there with this piece of paper thinking through the scene going like, okay, he's going to jump over this log here, swing on a tree branch here, and then stop and find a hang glider at the end of the cliff, right? So it's like thinking through like, okay, so in my mind, it's like, okay, ba-bum, okay, that's like, you know, 30, that's like 10 frames, and then it's going to take, you know, 6 frames for him to walk to the next thing, swing on the tree branch for 4 frames. And so you're like literally drawing lines down this spreadsheet kind of format of like this many frames, this many frames, this many frames.
So funny. Okay.
And, you know, for me, especially kind of, you know, I mean, I directed this short with the guy that we brought in, and, you know, I'm kind of doing this for the first time with him. And so he's kind of, you know, giving me feedback and going through it together. But, you know, it's this kind of weird moment where you're like, okay, this seems to make sense, but there's no visual feedback. So the only thing you're doing is like, I hope this works. And then you literally put that all in a box. And in our case, ship it to Korea.
Right. Right.
And then you get the first pencil test back. And that's where you start to go like, oh, like for the most part, it really did.
It works.
And then there are a few places where it doesn't. And then, you know, what I've always found, and, you know, I've also done a lot of work with overseas developers in, you know, kind of the web development world. And what I've always found working with any overseas companies, and I don't think it's no ding against them being overseas. It's just the distance and communication ability where, you know, in every case, you know, it's like no matter how much you've tried to kind of instruct and provide, you know, assets and resources and all that stuff, there's a certain amount of, you know, things that come back where you go, okay, well, they didn't quite get what I meant there. And right. So you get that first pencil test back for animation. And it's like, okay, largely this is working, but there are these, you know, scenes ABC, or these moments right. or whatever yes. that, you know, need refinement. And so, you know, especially back in that time, it's like, okay, so now you repackage the stuff that needs refinement, send it back or
so much.
Thank God some emails.
Seriously.
But you know, even so, it's still that same process. So it's like you get the pencil test back, refine the pencil test, you know, get another pencil test back. And then in our case, we would go from pencil test to then sort of inked cells or, you know, the yes. kind of the inked version of that. And then finally, once it's all working, you'd approve it for color. Then they would actually go and paint the cells in that case. Or yes, nowadays, it would be
backwards.
Digitally.
Right. Yeah.
And then you get your kind of finished picture and then, of course, go into post-production on audio and music and sound design and all that stuff.
Yes.
So it's quite an interesting process, and I do think, you know, a lot of that's been streamlined, especially in studios where more of it is being done in-house. Mm-hmm. But a lot of stuff is still sent overseas for animation, for the actual animation. I mean, a large percentage of it is actually animated overseas.
But those process pencil tests continues. And stuff, they are happening live in studio now, by and large.
Depends on the studio,
like
yeah.
Disney and places, yeah. you know.
Well, again, Disney's always been different. Because Disney...
And like, oh, yeah. Great, here's the entire movie yes. up on the walls.
Yeah.
In, you know, in a sequence like that, he's jumping over a log and then he's right. been here. It's like... Mm-hmm. Each of those frames is up on the wall yes. as a beat and yes. a beat and a beat and a beat.
I mean, that Disney Studio is always different. I think Disney Television Animation is a slightly different beast. I think mm-hmm. a lot of that stuff at least was, if not still is, also being handled overseas for animation. But the movie studio in particular, and I think this is true at at least some Cartoon Network show as well, like a larger percentage of the actual animation is being done in studio or, you know, in the States.
Yes.
And so then you do get that sort of more immediate feedback. But of course, you know, we live in a time now where even if it is being done overseas, it's all digital.
It's
and
so
you just,
easy
you know,
to go to
it,
them for a
get it. Yeah, exactly. So, yeah. You know, the tools have definitely improved. and the speed of communication has definitely improved. But I can only imagine, you know, what that must have been like, you know, even 5 years before the stuff that I did, and that, you know, you wouldn't have even had email or anything.
Of
so
course.
It's like, you know, so Paul, who was the person that we brought in to do that show with us, you know, he had worked at a time, he was an older guy, and he had worked at a time when he would literally be sent by the studio to Korea, to oversee, you know, as the kind of one person from yes. the team that would go and kind of see it on the ground level there.
Make
to
sure
try
it's
to,
working,
to try to eliminate
that. Of course. Of course. An incredibly laborious process. I mean,
yes.
it's so much more demanding production-wise, but why most animated films take 4 years
yep.
to produce.
Yep.
It's because it's such an iterative process, the
yep.
way that live-action filmmaking really isn't.
Yep.
You know, by and large, once you shoot a scene, you're done with that scene, and yep. obviously it's handed editorial list, lots
yep.
of work to be done on it, but you're not then going back and tweaking the performance.
Yes.
And back, you know, with some exceptions, you're then, once you've shot it, it's kind of set. It's
yep.
set, and then
yep.
you're off to the next thing.
Yep, exactly. Now, what I am interested about, and I don't actually know a ton about, but it's interesting watching my daughter once again. So I think, you know, the stuff that she watches falls distinctly into two camps. And it's, you know, it's Cartoon Network, it's Disney, it's Nickelodeon, largely kind of in those three categories mm-hmm. of content providers. But there's a definite delineation between the kind of... Yeah, I guess it's not really TV, at least in our case, it's streaming, but it's like there's the CG kind of streaming kind of kid yes. shows mm-hmm. versus the 2D kid shows.
Right.
And so, you know, in her case, it's like she really likes Peppa Pig, which is 2D.
Of course. Yep.
She also really likes, you know, PJ Masks, which is all 3D. And what's fascinating to me, and it's certainly a taste issue for me, but it's like I definitely find myself, you know, more... from an aesthetic point of view, you know, I find more appeal in the 2D stuff because it does feel like it has that, again, sort of a more of a sort of artistic or a auteur kind of, you know, point of view or hand behind it. Yes. Whereas I think a lot of the CG stuff that's produced sort of directly towards that age group feels a little kind of like you're playing with action figures.
It's very
mass production, you know, feeling.
Yeah, all the super Y and various come across those.
Yeah, yeah.
Become mm-hmm. bad CG animation. Yeah. And exactly, you're right, it feels like these action figures walking around this space.
Exactly.
In kind of slightly clunky fashion.
Yeah, and it's, you know, the animation's not bad. It's just the personality has largely been eliminated, I think, because you are dealing with... you know, relatively stock, you know, you've kind of got these CG characters and they don't have the time or the budget to, you know, to do what a Disney or an Illumination or, you know, Pixar does with them.
Yes.
So, you know, they do kind of have this, you know, not even, I would say like 5 years ago, it felt like very stiff and just not well animated. Mm-hmm. Whereas it's not even that so much to me anymore. It's that everything feels so mechanically created.
Right.
And so it just doesn't have the sort of life and personality that, you know, some of the other stuff
has.
It's
a bigger concern, whatever it is, where it is, there's so much content that has to be created to drive this thing that there is not the same ability to spend time on these things.
Yep, absolutely. And you know, budgets and all those things are a concern as well. You know, I mean, the one of the other things they mentioned, which I had not really thought about, but it's like as much as we're in the golden age of television, we are also very much in this golden age of animation. I remember somebody telling me at some point this year or late last year, it's like there are literally 150 buyers out there for animated content.
Jesus.
And that's, I mean, that's astonishing. It's like, you know, that's probably much more than the number of places that are buying live action at this point, you mm-hmm. know, certainly of quality live action.
Right.
So, you know, there's so many places that, you know, those things are being created and consumed. And so it's, you know, it's a great thing from the point of view of people that want to create animation. But it also means like it's harder and harder and harder to kind of get through to the top. You know, to the top of that pile, so to speak. So it's, you know, I think that the good news is it's like there really is, again, this sort of, there are homes for the sort of very distinctive stylistic points of view, story points of view, concept, you know, different interesting concepts. And I think that's really reflected in the, you know, the kind of array of material that's out there sort of at every age group, which is kind of great.
No, it's nice to see. It really is. It is good.
Yeah.
But it is, yeah, it's, you know, but obviously now it's taking, you know, it's, whereas animation, I think, used to be a far more smaller concern.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's, you know, Pixar spending $175 million a movie.
Oh, yeah.
Wreck-It Ralph was ahead of this. And then he gets one like Illumination who comes along and produces Despicable Me for $60 million and is coining money at that point.
Yeah,
because
absolutely.
They've worked out how to do this stuff less, again, embracing a limited style.
Yes. Yeah.
Or at least less
comparatively. Yes. Yeah.
Which is fantastic.
Yeah. No, it's amazing. I mean, I think that, you know, I guess that, you know, the key takeaway is it's like there's just so, you really can kind of do anything with it that you want. And what's fascinating is like everything, it's like, you know, it's like learning the process in whatever capacity that, you know, one is kind of moving towards,
right.
You know, then allows you to kind of take that fundamental process and apply it to all these
anything
different,
you want.
Know, different kinds of applications.
Yes. No, absolutely.
Very cool.
Yeah, very cool.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So, I'd forgotten. It's so funny because I'd forgotten that you had... I'd totally forgotten about Harry and Gotchi.
Yeah, absolutely.
You had all that, the very, very direct experience producing a 2D animated pilot.
Piece. Yep.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Fun.
Yep. And I will never say never, but don't see doing that again. So yes, very fun stuff.
Nice.
So Adam, we kind of shortcutted it. How was your week this past week?
The week was good. Just up and running again. We got to spend a lot of time this week, which was great. I was on hiatus from my Future Man show.
Yeah.
And so my wife and both children were out of town in different parts of the country. And so we actually got to spend a few days working together, which was great.
Yeah.
Doing a lot of work on
lots of story breaking
stuff. Which was a blast.
Yeah. So, yeah, if you're interested in crafting story worlds, that is last week's episode,
yes,
as
exactly.
well as a couple of others as well. A couple weeks back, we talk about that as well.
Yeah. But
lots of breaking story and kind of high level concept work around.
And then digging into a lot of the kind of minutiae as well. It's like, we're working in obviously the season arcs and then where we need to be and then what these characters are and choosing names, which is
always
challenging somehow.
Yep.
It's far harder than it should be.
Well, it's fun. I this is something that you're particularly attuned to, which I've come to really appreciate, is the, kind of finding names that do have some significance and to who the character is or what the character's role in the story is,
right?
Without telegraphing that. So it's this sort of, in my mind, a sort of fun Easter egg that, is kind of embedded within it. It's like, this, we're actually telling you who this character is based on the name, but it's not obvious.
It's not obvious. Yeah. And that was actually as funny because I was reading a thing. I've actually started gently rewatching season one of True Detective, which was amazing.
Yes.
And there was a breakdown of the character names. Mm-hmm. So, McConaughey's name is Rust Cole.
Yes.
And like what that implies. And this kind of degraded character and he's been through the ringer and he is this kind of deeply damaged thing. And he's, Cole, again, not spelled C-O-A-L.
Right.
But again, with this implication of kind of dirt and grunge and messy.
Yes.
And then, so he's Rust, and then the other chap is Dustin, I believe his name is Woody Harrelson's character.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the idea being Rustin and Dustin, so they're two sides of the same coin.
Yes.
And there's a couple of shots, after I'd read this, I was looking at it, there's a couple of shots where literally they're lined up so that the shot is a bit odd, but in context works beautifully, where one is facing the other, and they're facing opposite ways, but their head, they're framed in such a way that their heads are almost perfectly aligned.
Yes.
So you get this very deliberate two sides of the same coin.
That's
kind of
very
shot
cool.
Visual, backup of this of what the name means. So
that's very cool.
No, it's very, very cool.
Well worth rewatching, I'm sure.
Oh yeah.
Yes, very cool.
No, it's fascinating. And the other ones they talk about, kind of Reginald, which I guess is because come from Regis as in King. And so the idea in there's a the Yellow King is a constant refrain in that, and the people who are tied in, it's just all very, very thought out,
which is great.
Impressive.
Love that.
No, it's great stuff.
Absolutely.
And then a couple of days and obviously down, you were off and getting Dead Town ready and doing some fun stuff with that.
Yeah, so we've been as we've talked about before, we're prepping and almost wrapped up with season two of Dead Town Breakout, which is the Yarn series that we're doing, the prequel Dead Town prequel series that we're doing on Yarn. So I've been focused this last couple days on wrapping up some animated pieces for that. Speaking of animation. And then today in particular, struggling with a little bit of After Effects, which is always fun. It's funny. There's always something. Like every project that we do that has an After Effects component, there's always some After Effects issue to kind of figure out. The end result is always worth it, but it's always a little bit like,
oh my God, why aren't you working?
Yes, exactly. So wrapping that up and then moving on into season 3 and 4 of that as well. So we've broken all that, so we'll be moving into that. And we should be able to talk about, I'm assuming, on next week's show, a little more concrete detail as far as release schedule and that sort of stuff.
Because
these will be coming out soon, very soon.
Well, season one, I think, is going to be imminent.
Season one is going to relaunch. We did a season one that came out about almost a year ago, and we're relaunching it with a new episode and some new assets and a little bit of rewriting in the script. So that'll be interesting to see how that
honing.
see how that tracks. Well, and also, you know, honing it, getting some feedback based on the initial run.
Yes.
One of the fun things about what we've done with Yarn and their parent company, Mammoth Media, is, you know, we get access to all this kind of actual data from the people that have read it and responses. And so, you know, we're actually able to see literally even line by line in the story, kind of where do we lose people's attention or where did it, you know, where do people, you know, most resonate with the material. Yes. And so we can kind of tweak things based on that.
And it's very much, it's interesting because it's very much kind of a live feedback version of what the, you know, classic testing is for TV shows, movies, whatever else, where literally you have an audience and they have these dials they sit there with and they're watching the show and they dial it up when they're engaged and they dial it back down when they're not engaged. Mm-hmm. And these are things that kind of studio executives pore over.
Yes.
Oh my God, we've lost them at this point. We need to redo this scene. We need to recraft this thing. And sometimes they're incredibly useful and other times sometimes they're not. Just, like, shut up, that's fine.
Yes, exactly. So yeah, so there were a couple, not a bunch, but there were a few things that we were able to see in that data and kind of tweak a little bit. And then also, you know, as we went in, I don't think we knew going into season one that it was necessarily going to be a 4-season arc. We had some ideas, but not really, you know, had not really planned that part out at that point. And so as we went through seasons 2 through 4 and kind of figured out the whole story that we wanted to tell here, you know, we also noticed just a couple minor tweaks in season one that could kind of make that tie together a little bit better.
Exactly. And exactly. Looking at it as a kind of 4-season story.
Yeah.
As opposed to
a one-off.
Just a one-off.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So wrapping that up. So that'll all get done in the next day or two. And then again, we'll be able to say more about that next week, which is very exciting. It should be a lot of fun to have that come out, and even more fun for those of you listening to go and check it out.
Take a look at it.
Absolutely. Yep. So good stuff and fun times with the kids this morning and all that good stuff.
Yes,
so,
needs to be done.
What in the world is a Hoojima flip?
Hoojima flip is just anything that you cannot remember the precise name, definition, characteristics. You know, it's like what's his name?
It's a British whatchamacallit.
It's a bit exactly.
Yes, exactly. Which we love. So
Britishisms.
So we've adopted that as a Hoojima flip of the week. What is your Hoojima flip?
My Hoojima flip is definitely Incredibles.
Yes.
Happy to see that this morning.
So spoiler free.
Spoiler free.
Incredibles
simply
too.
Because I'm being, you know,
because you value our friendship.
Pay attention exactly to my friends who has not got to see this yet. It's not as good as the first one. Having just, so we rewatched last weekend. We rewatched the first one with my wife, who had never actually seen the whole thing.
And this is just criminal.
It's crazy. Yeah. Every now and then we wonder, like, how did we get married? but no, she hadn't seen the whole thing before. Whereas both kids obviously had and loved it.
Yeah,
and so got to rewatch that, and it's so good, and it holds up so well. It's just brilliant.
Yes.
You know, I maintain Incredibles is one of those, I think it was at a stage when Pixar was a little heavy time-wise in all their shows. So I feel like they went through this phase of kind of producing two-hour movies when, by and large, they didn't need to be. And there's no easy bit of Incredibles to point to that is too long. But somehow, you feel like, oh, if they could have trimmed 10 minutes from it, it actually would have been a better movie. Mm. Having said that, every minute is just amazing. I think despite that, so there was some extremely funny stuff in Incredibles 2.
Yes.
There's a specific sequence, which is not a spoiler in any way, with Jack-Jack fighting a raccoon,
that makes me laugh without even knowing what the context is.
And it's, it really, to me, recalled my kind of classic animation. Like, it recalled the kind of madcap beauty of great Warner Brothers.
Yes.
You know,
Looney Tune magic.
Yeah, those classic Looney Tunes. It was sublime. And I was crying with laughter. You know what's good when you know, my wife and I as well, we don't tend to share. We obviously share a great deal, but it's not. Our sense of humors can be a little
divergent.
Exactly. That's the way to put it. And it was great when we were both just howling with laughter at the same time, all three of us, our daughter as well.
That's great.
Very, very funny.
Yes.
And very apropos in terms of the kind of just the overall story with the guy having to get out of the way to let Elastigirl, you know, Mr. Incredible have to move aside to let Elastigirl succeed and what that means. And, you know, I think appropriate given a lot of the conversations happening in the country as a whole these days.
Kind of love that, actually. Yeah,
yeah, it's no, great. It's great. Perfect timing.
Yeah.
And, you know, and yet didn't quite have that magic that the first one had. Yeah. Didn't. You know, particularly the sequence, my favorite is Dash running away from the choppers.
Yes, yes.
And, you know, those amazing kind of Star Wars Return of the Jedi shots, like whizzing through the forest and then running on the water and then all that stuff is just it's so good.
Yeah.
In the first one. So the action sequence was great and the story was like all worked. Wasn't quite at that.
Didn't quite get to that. I mean, it's a very high bar. Yeah. I mean, I think to me, like, despite, you know, what debatable whether or not it could have been 10 minutes shorter, but I think it is still, as much as I love all the Marvel movies and everything else, it's still probably the best superhero movie made, and it is certainly the best Fantastic Four movie ever made.
Yeah, well, absolutely, yes. Sure.
And when Marvel gets the rights to the Fantastic Four back, fingers crossed, Comcast go away, then, you know, that would be the thing to look at when you're making your Marvel version of the Fantastic Four.
I definitely
need to see it.
You do.
So I am going to cheat once again and have two Hujima flips this week. The first one is I've been watching the first few episodes of Cloak and Dagger, which is a freeform Marvel show. So my first experience watching a freeform show, but it's surprisingly good and surprisingly interesting. So you know, part of it is I've always been a Cloak and Dagger fan. I think those characters are really interesting. I was very surprised when they announced it on Freeform as a show, and, you know, feels in some ways very disconnected from the rest of what Marvel's doing on television or otherwise.
Yes.
But it's surprisingly mature in some interesting ways.
That's nice.
So it's like, you know, it's not what I've found so far, which I particularly enjoyed, is it's a new take on the concept, which is not in any way a bad thing in this particular case.
Right.
But they're dealing with some things which are, you know, somewhat surprising. I think, like, kind of reversing tropes in some of the ways they're dealing with the particular characters or the interactions with the characters. In the first three episodes, you know, they're doing a lot of establishing over these first few episodes. So surprisingly, like, you're really not even into the hook yet.
Okay.
So a lot of setup, but in a way that feels natural and not at all, you know, it doesn't feel like it's moving too slowly. It's right. Like you're building these relationships and building this world. So I'm very curious now, like, how far they're really going to take it in this first season. But I've actually been enjoying that quite a bit, and it's left me with a, you know, sort of like, oh, I really want to kind of see what they're doing here and where they're going to take it and how they're going to build the story out and how they're going to bring these characters together and just sort of what this is all going to turn into. So it's been very enjoyable from that regard. And then my other Hujima flip this week has been a little secret, which I've decided to share with those who are fortunate enough to be listening to this episode.
Yes.
And that is an app called Werble.
Ooh,
W-E-R-B-L-E. So Werble is a little app that I discovered on the App Store. I'm sure it's on Google Play as well. And what it does is, you know, you do have to pay for it and you do have to buy these sort of effects packages. But what it does is it allows you to take a still photo.
Yes.
And add a bunch of very easy sort of effects to
overlay
it.
Effects,
so,
yeah.
You know, you pay to remove the watermark, basically, which is why it's been a secret up until now. But, you know, it's a very, actually very quick, easy, and good way to add some visual interest to, you know, photos and images that you're going to share on social media. So, you know, one of the things that I've been particularly doing with the Dead Town stuff that we post on Instagram is, like, you know, we'll add some film grain and add a little bit of smoke and maybe a lens flare, that sort of thing. And so just these little touches that just sort of bring this stuff to life. And one of the things that I notice on Instagram in particular, the way the algorithm is tweaked, that it does favor video content more than it does still image content.
Right. And this counts,
and so this counts as video content. Yes. And then also, I think as you're scrolling through the newsfeed, you still get all the glory of Steven's wonderful art, but with this sort of added layer of interest and motion. And so I think, you know, kind of grabs people's attention in the feed.
Right.
And I just think it's cool. I like the way it looks.
No, it's great.
You know, for those of you that are sharing on Instagram in particular, it's a very cool little way to add some extra interest. And there's everything from kind of, you know, funny little meme kinds of things, but also some pretty effective effects work, you know, that just becomes very simple to add to these things. So, you know, they've got everything from lens flares and film grain to, you know, flares
little
and
kind of animation and, stuff,
know,
as well.
Animation. Yeah, it's like you got some transition elements, you've got, you know, sparks and fire and like all kinds of fun stuff that you can kind of integrate into these images. So I really like that, and I do think it kind of adds a level of interest to some of the stuff that we post. So definitely check that out. Wearable.
Yes.
And Wearable, we'll take your endorsement now.
Yes, exactly.
and then finally, just a handful
Wait,
of calls.
No, that's three.
No longer a Hujuma flare. Moving into a little call to action here. So to kind of wrap up the show, you know, if you haven't been following along, we have an app ourselves on the App Store called Macroverse. Macroverse is a digital comics platform, and it's also where our launch series, Dead Town, is currently live.
Looking amazing.
So episode 1 through 8 is up there right now. Episode 9 should be coming out within the next week or two, and that will also be the end of season 1 of this particular story that we're telling. So definitely
a three season arc.
Exactly. So yes, much more to come, but the first kind of significant chunk of story is about to wrap up. It's all up there for free. You can find Macroverse on the App Store or Google Play. And at this point, we really just want your feedback and thoughts on the platform, on the story.
Exactly.
Everything that
reviews,
we're kind of building,
all that stuff.
And then the longer term vision for this is for this to really be as we think of it genuinely as the future of comics. We think we've solved a lot of the problems or challenges that, you know,
the digital platforms that
comics and digital have, but also in ways that, you know, people that are creating comics can kind of connect with a larger audience, can monetize that work in different ways. And so, you know, we're talking to a bunch of creators around other content to bring to the platform, as well as some of our other series as well. So there's lots more to come, and if you're anyone in that camp,
we want to be talking to you.
We want to be talking to you as well. So lots more to come there. Again, macroverse.media is the website. You can also find Macroverse on social media at Macroverse app.
Yep.
You can follow everything else that we are up to at M2Action, just about everywhere. And of course, this show also benefits greatly from your ratings and reviews. It helps other people find us in the various podcasting places that you might be listening.
So any reviews, stars, ratings, all that fun stuff.
Exactly. So
yes,
bring it to us, baby. And then finally, I just want to shout out again, our intro and outro music is by our good friend and long-term collaborator, Brandon Weisel,
yes,
who's a phenomenal composer in his own right and has done a lot of the work that we have done.
A lot of great work for us.
So with that, have a wonderful
fantastic week.
And we'll be back next week.
Indeed.
All right.
Bye.